right, folks, we are back on the Flysip.com podcast. Sitting in studio with my co-host, Scott McCloud. A little bit of an audio issue this week, but you know, that's podcast life in 2020. Nothing can go right in 2020. How are you?
I'm doing okay. If I can figure out my mic issues, I'd be a lot better. But hey, I'm going to sound like I'm across the Atlantic right now. How's that?
Sure. If you speak with a good Scottish accent, then you can make it anywhere in golf. I learned that.
Aye, laddie.
Well, you know, we just wrapped up our tournament, the Flagstick Open. What a great weekend all through and through. Congrats to Robert Mustard, Colonel Mustard, for repeating with a minus nine. Wait, he didn't repeat, did he? No,
I screwed up. He went in 2018. Second win, though, for
there
sure.
There you go. I was close. Minus nine, though. Great golf out there. Conditions were perfect. Boy, were those greens. They were lightning, like putting on a pool table. It was amazing. Great weekend by the entire team at Flagstick. You know, great starter. Got everyone's names right. long days for you, though. So what was your overall take on the experience?
Yeah, no, it was good. I mean, it was our largest field ever. We had 120. We had a waiting list. We had players in across from Ontario and Quebec. And yeah, you're right. I was on the tee doing starting for 238 calls. We might have missed a couple Warriors on Sunday morning, a little bit early tee time maybe for them. But I know feedback was great from all the participants. And it's always interesting to be on that first tee, and you know that yourself as far as getting out there and being a competitor and to see what the nerves are like and see how players react. And, you know, the golf course where we host at Equinel unfortunately has a large lake that looms on the first hole between the tee and the fairway. So it certainly affects some of those opening tee shots.
Yeah, the lake on number one affected my opening tee shot. Started the tournament with a nice seven, which is hard to get back from. But the lake is also what affected the couple lost soldiers we had. Pike Lake, unfortunately, this time where my cottage resides, took a few good men that just couldn't get up out of bed in the morning. And, you know, there's that old saying, you can't hang with the boys at night and not get up with the men in the morning. And a couple of them hadn't heard that saying and they didn't make it. But hey, they paid their dues to get in the tournament, and if they didn't want to show up on Sunday, I guess that's up to them. But a lot of people did. Sunday, it was, you know, I did not bring my best to the golf tournament. A lot of self-inflicted wounds out there. But I just got to say, I've been saying for weeks, if you can't find a fairway, if you're not driving the golf ball, there's nothing worse about golf. I was making 20 footers for bogey. I made five bogeys across the 2 days where I was three off the tee. So it's just like, just get off the tee and you're fine. Like it's just so frustrating to know if like I could just get off the tee consistently that, you know, things are heading in the right direction. But oh, it was a frustrating weekend for me, but all in all, super, super fun. A lot of good playing out there. There was a 68 from the C flight, which came out of nowhere. You know, I'm sure there's people out there commenting somebody's a sandbagger. Sure, could be the case. Who really cares at this point? And getting a lot of comments that we're probably going to get to into the in the mailbag about this, because a lot of different terms are going on with the RBC happening, the RBC scramble, and a lot of sandbagging going on in those tournaments, which happens. And then we're seeing some opposite too, which I'm going to call a Hollywood handicaps. And got me thinking, Scotty, what's more embarrassing? Having a handicap where you are basically flubbing every single score and lying about it so your handicap looks lower, or lying about every single score so your handicap goes higher so you can compete in higher divisions and get more strokes? What's more embarrassing to you?
Probably the one where, you know, you're not entering it properly and then you play exceedingly well. Probably just because of the fact that that's more likely to take something out of somebody else's game. I mean, if somebody goes the other way and has a Hollywood handicap, the only person they're hurting is themselves, really, more than anything, unless they're interfering with play of other players. But anytime you all of a sudden cross barriers and all of a sudden maybe take prizes out of somebody else's hands, it might be more of an issue. The other thing that people have to understand too, that, you know, and we can get to it, but our tournament's a little bit different than some of the other association tournaments and things that people may be used to. You know, we take the 120 players and we create the ABCD by dividing the field, and we create the index ranges that are there. So, you know, we talked about a little bit on previous podcast that our B flight started at 2 index. So the problem that we have sometimes is people see the results and they see a low score by somebody in C, for example, and they don't realize that person is a 6 handicap. You know, it's not the typical C that they might see at some other places where there's somebody that shoots in the 90s. The other side as well is it really depends on the golf course. Equinel is in fabulous shape. You're going to make a few more putts on that, hopefully. You're not getting as much interference that way. It's a fairly wide open golf course. And also, you know, we set up the layout for C and D flights, you know, a little bit more generous. 69 is the course rating, just over 6,200 yards. So it's certainly available for scoring. So you have to take that into account before you sort of start making assumptions about what's going on. But I'd say that Hollywood handicap, you know, help yourself to that one. It's the sandbagger stuff that really caused the issues.
I agree with you 100%. Nothing more embarrassing than being like, I need this hybrid or this to win. My thing that I keep seeing from people, especially with the RBC Scramble stuff, is, you know, complaining that this team won with this. And I like to flip that back on to them usually and say, so is your entire team's handicap perfect and right what it should be? Or are you just upset that another team was able to flub theirs more than you were? It's tough when you're playing handicap tournaments. And if you're upset by it, play in open tournaments, play in the A flights and compete with them. Just like Jim Herman did this weekend. Our boy, Jim Herman. We talk about not turning your shoulders in the backswing. I don't even think Jim Herman moves his body. It's just straight arms up, straight arms down, hits fairways, hits greens, and picks up a win. Big weekend, 61-63. You and I, you know, we're not going to comment too much on it because we were both at the golf course all weekend, but, you know, nice to see different golf yet again. It's like the naysayers are shutting up the people that are like, Bryson's are ruining golf. The long hitters are ruining golf. I think Jim Herman averages like 270 off the tee or something like that. 285 off the tee. Currently 188th on the PGA Tour. If he's averaging 285 off the tee, probably carrying it 260. So there's a lot of different ways to get it done, and these guys are showing that's the case.
Yeah, there really is. And I mean, for him to shoot 61, 63 on the weekend, I guess, you know, you're right. He's the anti-DeChambeau. He's definitely not the player that's going to hit at 380. But you know what? It's the lowest score wins. And no pitchers on scorecards. And I think that was part of the problem with people always seem to assume that, you know, when there's a run of long hitters, is they're saying, oh, the game has totally changed. They're going to dominate the game. But, you know, when it comes down to it, you still got to put the golf ball in the hole. And that's really what it amounts to. It is a scoring game. It is not a long drive contest. And sometimes long drivers will win. Sometimes the Jim Hermans will win.
Yeah, and you actually have a story about Jim Herman from back in 2010 at Q School. Why don't you run this story down for us?
Yeah, I was down at Q School in 2010 following Canadian Matt McQuillan, who's a friend, and he was down there qualifying. Was successful in the end, but one of his pairings one day was with Jim Herman, and it really stuck with me, especially after, you know, seeing him win again. He actually played the back nine on one of the rounds. He played the back nine par fives and even par, but he did it in the most unusual way. The first par five, he was trashing around in the weeds. Scraped his way to a triple bogey, and then a few holes later, he actually made a 2 on the other par 5. So he went 8-2 to shoot even. So again, many, many different ways to get it done.
Absolutely. Well, Jim will be in the field this week at the Northern Trust. You know, had to win that basically, I think, to even get in, and that's what he did. I was actually kind of shocked. Tiger's in the field this week. Didn't really expect that considering, you know, the amount of time he's playing, but I think he recognizes he needs to have a big playoffs and starts with this event. Playing with Dylan Fratelli and Kirkpatrick there. That was the bigger shock to me, though. Is that, like, usually the PGA Tour gives Tiger some soft, you know, guys that he's used to, the JTs of the world, the Rorys of the world, and there he is out with Dylan Fratelli. And I'm drawing a blank on Kirkpatrick's first name even at this
point.
Matt Kirkpatrick. There you go. Like, so I'm really interested in that. Like, I wonder how that, it's going to be a feature group. You're going to be able to watch it on Golf TV and on the PGA Tour app in the United States. Very interesting to see that down at TPC Boston. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I thought it was an odd pairing. I mean, they pushed out the feature groups today, and, you know, you're kind of looking through them. You see some of the usual suspects, and, you know, you know they're going to want the TV rating. So Woods is going to be a feature group, no doubt. It doesn't matter where he is as long as he's in the field. But, yeah, to stick him with Dylan Fratelli, who, you know, whose name has probably come up more in the last little while because of the positive COVID test. Matt Kirkpatrick, more people have been talking about him because, you know, Bones McKay came out and caddied for him for a couple of holes. So really not a huge feature group as it is. And you're right. It's not as friendly as they usually have for Woods. So I'm not sure what went into that, but I guess, you know, when you've only got a certain number of players to choose from, but still, yeah, it is kind of a strange.
This is actually even more embarrassing. There's no such thing, no such person as Matt Kirkpatrick, because his last name is Fitzpatrick. And no wonder neither one of us had any idea who this guy was. God. So tough start. Our audio's not good. Our notes are worse. You can hear Scotty type in to fix the notes in case we go back to this. great start to the podcast. Well, what can you expect after a long weekend?
I need more coffee. I clearly need more coffee. Put in a lot of 14, 15 hour days this weekend, and I don't even know how I wrote that. That's crazy. Anyways, now we're moving on.
The people you want to be watching out for this week, though, Ricky Fowler, Brooks Koepka, Jordan Spieth, Graham McDowell, and Shane Lowry, these are the guys all in between the 70 to 125 category. So they need some big weeks heading into next week and continue on in the playoffs. But, one thing that came up last week, so Jim Herman obviously picked up a win, and it got me thinking about where we're at and the equipment manufacturer race. The season ended, and I just kind of want to know who won the season from an equipment manufacturer standpoint. So I did some research, because this is what we are on this podcast. I'm a avid journalist. You're only going to get
like our accurate facts in the last segment.
Yeah, you're only going to get accurate facts on this podcast. So I'm going to run through it, and maybe, you know, people might be shocked by the winner, maybe they won't be. So we're going to go down. There's a couple winners from the mixed bag category to start. Brendan Todd falls in that mixed bag category with two wins. Rory Sabatini got a win with Kevin Tway on that partner event. He's in the mixed bag category. And then Patrick Reed as well picked up that win at that WGC in that mixed bag category. In the one win category, we have Cobra and Wilson. A shock to see Cobra with only one, and that came from Bryson. I thought Bryson had won more this year, which he had not.
That feels like it. Everybody's been talking about it that much.
Yeah, but no, he didn't. Again, Kevin Tway picked up that win for Wilson. Callaway coming in fourth with four. Kevin Na picked up a win. Henrik Stenson picked up a win. That shows how much COVID's taken over, that Henrik Stenson won, and I totally forgot about it. Leishman picked up a win, and Daniel Berger, again, a guy that I swore won a couple times, but he was just on fire for a while. So they got four. Ping coming in third place with seven wins, with Thompson, Champ, Neiman, Munoz, Landry, Hovland, and Hatton, which was awesome. And then
it sounds like a law firm.
Hovland and Hatton. I like that. Maybe they should go into business. So it comes down to TaylorMade and Titleist. Who won it out? Drum roll, please. Coming in first place was Titleist this year, and they can thank Justin Thomas and Webb Simpson for five collective wins together. They had 10 wins total. TaylorMade had 9 wins. Thought that was interesting, though. Just a quick breakdown, and I wonder year over year. I'm going to give a big shout out to Titleist, though. We talk about, the tour not paying as much anymore in terms of equipment manufacturers go. Titleist is one that probably is one of the lower paying ones from my understanding as well. They know the quality of everything they make. Their golf ball, you know, continues to be number one week in, week out. And here we are, 10 wins, winning the season. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, they've managed just to kind of turn some things around in the last couple of years. Once they came out with those TS Woods, they really jumped back into the wood game as far as market share. And, you know, we saw week after week that they would often sweep which was really rare to sweep, though, all the equipment categories to come through. Now, you know, how much value do we put in this? It's hard to say, because obviously if people are being, you know, paid their endorsements, does it mean that it's better, or does it just mean that there's more players that are using it? I don't know. I mean, it's hard to say what the true value is of that. Mixed bags are always, like, I think, the testament more than anything. We start to see equipment in there where players are not paid to play that equipment that maybe provide a little bit a better or a stronger endorsement. But obviously, a little bit of a flip in the manufacturers. And like you said, if Titleist is not paying, you know, maybe as much, that does lend them, you know, lend them to have a little bit of authority of these players, you know, maybe making use of that equipment and not jumping over somebody else just for the money. They're wanting to play that equipment with ticketer. So there's probably some insights you can get out of that.
I agree. But this got me diving into Twitter, and a long time ago, there was a golf company, seems a long time ago, called Adams Golf. And Adams Golf has been tweeting recently. Now, this account has been stale for a while, since probably 2015, when they kind of wrapped up production after everything ended with their relationship with TaylorMade. Hadn't really heard further from them after that. You're in the biz. What are you hearing? Are you hearing anything? Anything that you can say?
No, there's not really much, but it's obviously an indication that, you know, the marketing team has obviously, you know, brought back this account, which, as you said, has been stale for a number of years. Kind of has some indications that maybe, you know, they're trying to bring it alive again, get into some SEO, get some people following the account. You got to think there's some probably some people that came into the game in the last 5 years that have no idea who Adams is, even though this is a company that, you know, dates back 20 plus years. I have not heard anything, but I would expect at some point, and I did expect this in the last few years, that Adams would be brought back in some shape or form. I would expect what we're going to do is we're going to see this maybe fit into a different market segment for TaylorMade. If they do bring back the brand and equipment, and this is the right time to do it, because obviously we're starting to see fall introductions as far as product is concerned, I would say they're going to bring it in into the player improvement category. And that's where they were slotted for many, many years. They tried for a while to bring them into sort of the premium, low handicap player level, but I think it really fits well in that next level underneath where some of the premium products are in that improvement category. And I think you're going to see more and more products. Callaway just introduced some new products today, a new line of Big Bertha products, new woods, hybrids, irons that were more after the forgiving market. You know, they're after playability, anti-slice, higher launch, that sort of thing. So I would not be surprised if we see an introduction here in the next little while from that.
I agree. We see this quite often, though. You know, brands come back. Ben Hogan was one of the big brands back in the day. They've tried to make comebacks many times. It's been a struggle to get a market share. You know, even see it on the wall. McGregor, same kind of deal. You see them come and go. You know, at one point, you know, they're, you know, a low-end brand for, you know, big golf stores. So I would love to see Adams come back. They always had amazing players hybrids. That was the thing for me, the players hybrids. And obviously TaylorMade still has all that technology, but I don't know. There was just something to know, and they made great woods too. But I agree that the market that I thought they were really going to take over that you'd see is kind of the Champions Tour, the seniors market, the forgiving market, more in the ladies lines as well, and just never seemed to get there. So I'm looking forward to it. I'll be watching that Twitter account as maybe some more tweets come up in the next couple days. But speaking of the ladies market, let's head back over to the LPGA Tour. They got their first major this week. But before we get to that, Stacey Lewis picks up her win last week in Scotland. First time she's won since 2018, which is big because in 2018 she became a mother. So big news for her. But kind of the big news that came afterwards when she came out and just started ripping apart the slow play. I don't know who she was playing with at the time. Again, we'll preface, both of Scott and I were at golf courses for about 12 hours each day, Saturday, Sunday. But her final round was 5 hours and 16 minutes. She knew it was going to be long. She said coming into it that she said to her caddy she wasn't allowed to complain once during the round about slow play. She said she was singing songs to herself to save time. this is awful. Like what can we do out here? Like I would love to see the shot clock brought back in there. I saw a lot of slow play in our tournament this weekend, just guys where it's just like, pull the trigger, man. What are you doing?
That said, our final group did play in 4 hours and 24 minutes. So it's just, you saw it sort of intermittently. It's not as bad as this, which was 5:16 for a final round.
Awful. But, you know, outside of shot clock, what other cool ideas do you think we could implement for slow play? I think the biggest thing is you just got to start doing penalties right away. Like, and I think we have way too long of a leash on slow play. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, the leash is definitely a big thing. I mean, there are regulations in play as far as timing, but you don't see that being enforced as much as it could be. I think it takes too long for the penalties to come in there. You know, they do have fines, but for most of the players, even when they have fines, they don't pay attention to it because it's so little amount. And really, the players that are in contention, you know, the money that they're going to win, whether it's PGA Tour, LPGA Tour, or whatever, is, you know, much more than what the fines are going to be, so they don't bother. So I think most of the players have basically said it's going to have to come down to shots. It's going to have to come down to actual penalties where, you know, you get that situation where it's not, you know, four warnings. It's, you know, kind of you get one warning and your next one is, you know, some sort of penalty, not a stroke. It could be a two stroke. It's got to be severe enough so that the player is going to think about it. And it's got to be, you know, it's got to be impactful so that it's done. I mean, I've seen so many tournaments sometimes where players are playing along and then, you know, officials maybe go, oh, well, you know, they're in the lead, and it's going to have to be a lead group at some point where they're going to have to drop the hammer and somebody's going to have to lose the tournament because of it. To really make an impact. It can't be just giving the penalty to, you know, the amateur kid from China at the Masters. You know, it doesn't have an effect on the outcome. They think they're making a statement, but they're not. So it's going to really have to come down to saying that, yes, just because of, you know, a group of players are in the lead and they're contending for the title, you can't really condone it. You got to really set example. And I think that's going to have to come down to strokes themselves and not penalties as far as fines are concerned.
100% agree with that. You know, penalties are the only way you're going to actually see changes and learning. And we're going to talk a lot about the LPGA's first major after our interview this week, which I haven't even mentioned. We have Ryan Hart again. You probably heard him on the podcast earlier this year talking about the Players' Championship, as he's the tournament director for that tournament. And he's now the executive director for the 2024 Presidents' Cup at Royal Montreal. We talked about that last week. So we're going to get to Ryan in just a moment. But before we do, we got to wrap up the week that was. I don't know anything else that happened at the U.S. Amateur other than this massive caddy mishap. Basically the story goes that they're getting down to the 18th hole, and the guy, the playing partner, I believe his name was Olive. I don't know his last name off the top of my head. See, this is what our podcast is known for, just having all the facts ready. If I got Scott to do it, he's probably going to call him Olive Kirkpatrick.
Oliva Pinto, I guess.
Oliva Pinto. So they're tied on 18. He hits it into a bunker. The guy goes, looks in the bunker, sees shot. He's walking around the green. His caddy gets in the bunker and starts making sandcastles in there. And, you know, as a caddy, A, there's two things here. As a caddy, you're never supposed to touch the sand other than to rake in. And B, when have you ever seen a caddy go in the sand with his player to come up with a shot? Even from a standpoint of a fairway bunker, you don't even see it. That's just more work for the caddy. So you're not going to go in there. Like, what was his play in there? That he's hopping in the sand. He's like, he feels it around. He goes, yep, that sand. You should probably try to hit a sand shot. Like, I have no idea what he was trying to do here. Cost his guy the match. Devastating. The kid took it very well. How would you be handling that situation? Because I can tell you, I wouldn't be handling it that well.
No, I mean, it was shocking. I mean, one, you're right. What's he doing in there for sure? You know, is it a local? I think it was a local
Bandon
caddy.
Bandon Dunes, local caddy. Yeah, he's a rookie caddy at Bandon Dunes, which we'll give a pass to. But
he's got to be trained as far as that. And you got to remember, the player he ended up his player ended up losing to ended up winning the whole thing. So, you know, this really impacted what was going to happen throughout the whole tournament. I mean, you got to remember the winner, you know, gets an invitation to the U.S. Open, the Masters, the British Open. I mean, a player got denied, you know, because of that, you know, a young guy who plays for Arkansas. It's shocking, but I don't know what you do. I mean, you assume, obviously, when you go to play that tournament, you get a caddy from that place. You assume it's just not a guy who's, you know, just picked up a bag. So
you don't, thinking, you don't get Stefan Tiedorf out there.
You're aware of that. You're not going to do that. So I don't know what you can do, because you were sitting there in shock. You have no real retribution of, you know, what? You just don't tip the guy? I mean, really, at that point, you know,
you just lost your weekly, I think.
Yeah, I assume somebody's going to, you know, probably want to, you know, give this guy a cold talk across the face or whatever. That's not really going to solve anything. But, you know, this guy's just trying to make an up and down to win the match. And then all of a sudden, and the other part is the caddy denied it.
Oh, he denied it. I did some research, and maybe it's an excuse, maybe it's not. Some research found that usually before the U.S. Amateur, they do actually a full caddies rules official meeting. They sit them all down. Right. They run them through the rules. This is a rule that they would have gone through in a normal year. Now we are in 2020. So such thing as a normal year in 2020. So this did not take place. They were all handed sheets of paper with the normal rules they would go over. Now you and I both caddy. There's many times you're handed that sheet of paper, and there's every single time you don't read that sheet of paper. So I think that's exactly what went down. He just didn't read that sheet of paper. Cost his guy the match, probably cost them a lot of money from a job standpoint out there. I have seen guys like from the Caddy Network and such reach out and be like, I'm going to Bandon. I want him on the bag. It's you know, we've all made a big mistake. Unfortunately, his big mistake in his rookie year wasn't on the Symetra Tour like most of the other guys are. It was on national stage at the U.S. Amateur. He'll recover from this. I'm sure he'll have a great career as a caddy, but it's just devastating to see, you know, a guy lose like that.
Yeah, and it's got to be hard, too. I mean, for a facility like that, I know, you know, you've got 264 players there. Not everybody, especially in this year, is going to bring their own caddy, which would be the normal situation for a lot of people. You're going to the U.S. Amateur, you're going to bring a caddy. They were allowed to bring one person with them. They were allowed to have one person within the bubble, but a lot of players brought a coach. So they depended on Bandon Dunes to do that. So I heard a couple of people as well saying, oh, well, why would you go play in the U.S. Amateur and, you know, get a rookie caddy? You know, take somebody that you know, that you trust. So I'm not going to sit there and deflect the blame from this guy. He just shouldn't have done it, first of all. But, you know, it's not the first time that a caddy has made a big mistake before. We've seen lots of them over the years.
Yeah, I've been close, very close a couple times. I'm not going to get into them and out myself, but there's been close situations. What's the biggest mishap that you've seen in person, or maybe you've personally done?
Personally, I've never had too many issues. I mean, I've had a few times where I maybe got a wrong number just because I looked at the wrong tee box or something like that. Or, you know, you go to check out a sprinkler head and you assume it's the wrong sprinkler head. But thankfully, I've never been in a situation where all of a sudden the player actually hit that club. I did have one situation where the player actually said to me, you know, what tee box is that from? What mark is that from? And then I realized that, you know, they were about to hit a club that was going to be about three clubs too strong on a par three. Thankfully, it was an amateur golfer at that time, so it wouldn't have cost them any money, and they weren't going to miss or weren't going to make the cut in the professional event anyways. But a guy named Will Mitchell, who is a Canadian from the Pickering Whitby area, was playing the Mackenzie Tour years ago. And I don't know if I think I may have mentioned this one on the story or on the podcast before, but this is a guy who was playing the Canadian Tour, hadn't made any cuts all year long. And then all of a sudden in one event, he caught fire, was in the lead, just running the tables, looks like he was going to win the event, going to secure his card, keep his status for the next year. And he was down to the last couple of events of the year. Then it turned out that one of the other players reported that the caddy that he had was standing on his line, standing behind him most of the time as he set up to hit his shots and hit his shots, including some putts as well. And they went back, talked to him, talked to the caddy. Caddy was a local caddy, did not realize or understand that he was not supposed to be on the line. And unfortunately, Will went from sure win to disqualification. And within a couple of years, he was out of playing pro golf.
Damn.
Yeah, not good.
And I thought I did a bad job when Kevin Chappell stared through my soul after I dropped the golf bag and was ready to cut me into a million pieces. That's worse.
Was that for you? Was that the biggest one you think?
Absolutely. Was the faux pas? It's a fluke thing. They say put the bag down. I didn't even realize he said that he was going to go. We were clearly away, but we were still trying to figure out everything.
This wasn't the round he shot 59 in, was it?
No, it was the first round, thankfully. We had a good round that day. Thankfully, not that day. Biggest fear, that I will out myself on. The bag fell over when it shouldn't have. Luckily, he was just addressing his ball. A great guy through and through. But that was easily my scariest. But not even close to that.
I've seen some funny ones. I mean, I've seen caddies kind of back into bunkers and fall into bunkers. You see it if you go out on the McKenzie Tour. Probably not as much these days because a lot of guys will bring out a friend and maybe caddy on the McKenzie Tour. But in the old Canadian Tour days, you saw all sorts of manners of volunteers be out there. So there was guys that, like I said, would fall into bunkers. There was one where a guy, I guess one time, he not only tripped into the bunker, but he caught the rake between his legs at the same time and snapped the leg or snapped the handle of the rake at the same time and apparently stabbed into his leg. So caused a delay in play, injury to himself. They had to get a substitute caddy. The whole thing.
That explains the Canadian Tour perfectly.
Back in the day,
The old the old Canadian Tour. That explains it perfectly, through and through. Just chaos. I'm gonna leave everyone with one last chaotic story that came out of the Flagstaff Open this weekend. So the 18th hole, a player's coming in. 18th hole is a par five. There's the clubhouse behind, people park their carts behind and everything, early group to go up. Don't know the name of the player. Okay, we're not going to out the name of the player. So let's say he caught one a little thin on 18, blasts it 35 yards over the green, hits a golf cart, hits the seat of the cart, and lands in the cup holder, right? Which you're like, how does that even happen alone? It gets a little bit better. In the cup holder is a bag of peanuts. Turns out the player that hit that shot was allergic to peanuts. Shout out to us peanut allergy guys out there. We'll be talking about this at the next meeting. This has to be a rules official's nightmare / what they get up for. Like, probably go, so exciting. So walk us through, how was the decision made? What happened? How did the outcome finish?
Well, I was standing right behind the cart when he yelled four, so I ducked down, looked up, saw the ball hit the seat, jumped into the cup holder. The odd part, of course, was that there already was another ball in the other cup holder. So when he came up, first of all, I had to sit there and say, yeah, that was the one that was over here, but they had to get him to identify it. Odd part was unlucky 13 was the number of the cart. We mentioned that to him. He said, well, I already made a 12 today, so that's kind of appropriate. So even worse as far as that's concerned. So what they had to do was he had to take a towel, remove the ball out of there, and then they had to get the player who had the cart, get him to move the cart, and then they dropped the ball approximately right below where that cup holder is onto the cart path. Then he had to take relief from the cart path, then play from there down to the green. Forget what he ended up making. I think an 8 or something like that on the hole, but it was certainly a really rare circumstance, and it was one of those ones that you're always going to remember. That's for sure.
That is crazy. Yeah, you don't think that would ever happen, but here we are. Golf's a weird game. What it's even weirder is we have a Canadian that has just taken over the PGA Tour and now taken over the President's Cup. You don't think this is going to happen usually. These Canadians, we don't get these shots always. But Ryan Hart's done us proud. We've had him on before. We're going to have him on again. We're going to talk about Royal Montreal and the 2024 President's Cup. So without further ado, one of our favorites, Ryan Hart. All right, folks, we'd like to welcome back to the podcast one of our favorites, Ryan Hart, the now executive director of the 2024 President's Cup at Royal Montreal. What's going on, Ryan?
How you doing, guys? Thanks for having me back.
Oh, we're happy to have you back. we not only do we have you back on the podcast, we have you back in our country, fresh off a move back from Florida to Winnipeg. Is there anywhere maybe Arkansas to Winnipeg, but outside of Florida to Winnipeg, they're two drastically different places you could move to in North America at this point.
That's a stretch. I mean, I have been to Yellowknife, so I think, you know, Yellowknife to Florida might top it, but it's pretty close. It was a great experience down there, and definitely will be back and forth over the coming years. But being back home in Winnipeg and back home in Canada, really excited about the next few years and the lead up to 2024 in Montreal.
Well, since we last chatted, obviously, when we chatted, the players had, you know, been canceled due to the coronavirus. We had just wrapped up the TaylorMade Driving for Relief Challenge. Since then, you've done the match with Tiger and Phil and Peyton and Tom Brady. Let's talk about that. What was that experience like?
You know, completely different one, funny enough, only 2 weeks apart, but completely different than TaylorMade from the standpoint that we were really involved in that one from a health and safety protocol perspective. Obviously, it was another week where we had a chance to test a lot of the things that we were trying to really do as we returned to golf at Charles Schwab at Colonial. And, you know, it was a wild experience. I mean, to be around those four icons and watch their preparation, but also how much fun they had. And I would say the common respect between each of them, that was something that definitely I'll cherish for a while. But two completely different events, two completely different golf courses, one definitely a lot drier than the other, but just great experiences all around.
Did you, you know, you say about them having respect for each other. Is it kind of a weird situation because you've got Tiger, you know, who's such an icon in the game and his sport, but, you know, he's playing with these other athletes that are, you know, icons themselves. So, you know, did you look at it and say, you know, you could see Tiger was maybe, you know, looking to them for certain things that maybe, you know, other people would look to Tiger for?
I don't know about that. I think, you know, all I could say is that in being around them, there was a lot of talk about how they prepared for each of their respective crafts. I would say that was probably as much as I was around them for that, let's call it 48 hours. I would say that was the biggest thing that I heard. You know, it was sort of, you know, you've had this injury. How did you work to come back from that? And those sorts of things. It was really, like I said, I think a mutual admiration for what they each have done in their careers. But to see them just as pure competitors, I mean, Tom Brady was, I think it was documented even that day in the telecast. I mean, he was there 7-something in the morning getting warmed up. I don't think we teed off till 3:40. And he was, you know, doing wind sprints in the parking lot, and pushing push-ups and things of that nature until the holes were cut so he could get out and play the course, you know, in the condition it was going to be that day. So he was definitely there the longest that day, I would say. But yeah, like I said, from a preparation perspective, it was pretty wild to watch those icons, really.
Well, I mean, he's still preparing for the next season on top of wants to look good out there. Yeah. Tough front nine for him, other than that hole out and, you know, ripping a hole out of his pants on top of that. But overall, that was a super entertaining event. I thought everyone did a great job on it. And congrats to you and your team for that. So since the match up to the President's Cup announcement at Royal Montreal, what were you doing in between? I assume you were part of the restart of the season. What were those conversations like? And what else did you have going on?
Just sitting back. No, I'm just kidding.
just chilling.
I think honestly, you know, as time has sort of progressed here, we as an organization, everybody's just putting on multiple hats and really pinching in where we can. I think, you know, from the commissioner on down, it's a roll up your sleeves and do what we can. I mean, we've been really fortunate to be back playing, be back on TV and humbled for that opportunity across the board, I think. But But, you know, it takes a lot to do what we're doing right now, even though there are no fans. So I think a lot of people, including myself, are doing jobs that you didn't think you would be doing, maybe. Still definitely involved in some of our safety protocols. We're working on different programs with a lot of our clients virtually. We've got a program that we were trying to figure out. You have all these experiences that you, I don't want to say you take for granted, but each and every week on tour where, you know, just something like a pro-am. Well, we can't do that right now. So we've created this, it's called a greenside chat, where we'll have three players and a moderator basically spend half an hour to 40 minutes with our clients each week. And we create a T-sheet, work with competitions as we would any other week, create a T-sheet of groupings. And then each of our clients get so many people in that Zoom call. And, you know, there's sort of a hype video at the beginning, and you really get... It's a really neat experience to see these guys chat and go back and forth and really interact with the clients. I mean, I think they realize, you know, the impact of these clients on what we do week in and week out. And just to see the respect that they show them is pretty wild. So those are the few of the things. And then also, you know, working on a few parallel paths. I'm still helping with my transition at the Players Championship. So I'll still be involved in 2021. To an extent. And so working with the team on that and preparing for 2024.
So you mentioned obviously the clients, and they're a very important part as far as the PGA Tour, you know, getting the sponsors involved. The community is very important for you guys as well. So were there any things, any type of interactions or any programs that, you know, the tour is doing or working on to, you know, keep that tie with the communities that they support so well through their events throughout the year?
I think every week's a little bit different, depending on the organization. I mean, if you go back a few weeks ago now to Memphis and St. Jude, I mean, massive, massive community partner of ours, and they do such amazing things with the kids that they support. So that one, usually we have players go to the hospital and spend some time with the kids. So for that one, it was a lot more of a virtual experience with the kids and personalized messages and those sorts of things, still trying to have some engagement. So I think that's really what we're trying to figure out right now. I mean, if there's things that we can do every week, I think the guys are doing an unbelievable job, you know, signing more items than maybe they normally would, because they know that we just don't have those touch points that we normally do. And, you know, each of them, I think, is doing their own thing too behind the scenes. And I think that's one of the really special things that you know, maybe doesn't get shown a lot, is I keep hearing stories week in and week out of what some of these guys are doing on their own time or funds that they're contributing to a cause that's just near and dear to them in a community that they've been playing in for years. So it's really a mix week in and week out. Largely virtual, but really just to see these guys realize that is pretty special.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. And, you know, it's well documented how great the PGA Tour is with their charity endeavors, and the players take their time, and glad to see that has not changed, even though the world we're living in has drastically changed from what we're used to. Let's take it to a personal level. Obviously, you know, big announcement being announced as the executive director for the President's Cup in 2024, which is awesome. You know, would have been great regardless of where that was taking place. Now we're talking about it being a home game for you. How, what were the feelings going through your head when all of this came together, knowing this is happening on home turf for you?
I think a huge sense of pride. You know, when this conversation started about moving to the President's Cup team, that was one thing. And I mean, it is our largest global event. So I think that there was a lot of excitement at that point at the opportunity. And then when Royal Montreal came into the picture, you know, it's like you said, it's a home game. And we're passionate sports fans up here, as you well know. But I think we're some of the most passionate golf fans as well. I mean, you look back at 2007 when it was there the first time, and you look at the roars when, you know, Mike Weir beat Tiger on Sunday and just throughout the week, and players and people that were still there, that were there in 07 still talk about it. And I wasn't on Monday or last Monday when we made the announcement, you know, I wasn't kidding when I said, you know, it has really been seen as one of the most successful ones in the history of the President's Cup, and largely due to the fan support. Andy Pazder, who is our chief competitions right now, he was part of that event on the player relations side in 2007. And when he had heard that I was going to take that opportunity, he called right away and he said, you know, one of the greatest memories in his career was going up to Canada and experiencing that. So there's a huge amount of pride, but even more so, I truly believe that this event is tailor-made for our country. I mean, the U.S. versus the world, in a lot of ways, I think, you know, we are, just as a culture, we're extremely welcoming to other cultures and we celebrate them. And to be able to do that with the international team and all the different cultures and hopefully Canadians on that team together and put our country on the global stage and on display is, I mean, it's super exciting to me. I still don't even really know how to put it into words, but.
Yeah, no, it will be exciting to see, you know, hopefully, you know, guys like Corey Connors, who just missed the last time around, and Adam Hadwin and Nick Taylor, hopefully, you know, guys like that, Mackenzie Hughes, and who else knows who's coming up the pipeline will be there. And Taylor Pendrith, exactly, just, you know, was on the podcast last week. Not out of the question by any stretch at this point. We'll be on that team in 2024. I want to bring it back to last year's President's Cup because, you know, it's safe to say it's not usually the tightest matchup in the history's past. But last year, I think, changed that and made it quite an exciting year for the President's Cup. How big was that for you, do you believe, that seeing it being a tight matchup, right, came down to the Sunday, you really had no idea who was going to win. How important was that for you as a, you know, trying to market such a big thing, especially in our country?
I mean, it's huge. Competition's huge in any sport. You want to see people compete at the highest level and you want to see a good battle. And I think you saw that last year. It's funny, if you really think back and you look at the history of the Ryder Cup, until the Europeans started winning on American soil, the Ryder Cup really wasn't what we see today. I mean, it was still, I have the utmost respect in the history of the event and all the stories and highlights that we've seen over the years. But when you look at it as the magnitude of what it is today, that really happened when the Europeans started winning on American soil. So I think when, you know, and this is a different one. I truly believe this is a hybrid event in Montreal. Yes, it's an international event. Yes, it's played on quote unquote international waters. But because it is in North America and the proximity of it all, I mean, I just have a feeling that you're not going to know who's up or down when you get to Montreal, because there's going to be so many people traveling to get it from, or to get there from south of the border. So I think, you know, the environment is just going to be electric. And if we can get another event similar to Royal Melbourne, you know, hopefully the internationals can pull one out.
Yeah, in Montreal last time, I was down there for that. I mean, I don't know what all your memories are of it, but one thing that was really distinctive for me that week was talking to some of the players of how much they loved Montreal and how it felt to them like an international city. It didn't feel like an American city, even though they were close, you know, and they thought, oh, well, Canada is a little bit different than maybe what we thought it was. Is there ways that, you know, you can maybe sort of take advantage of that to make the experience great for the players off the golf course as well for that week?
I think it's huge. I think from the fans and the players, you know, we want to be able to showcase. And Montreal, I've said, is probably one of the most, as much as it's Canada, one of the most European experiences you can get in our country. I mean, you walk around the cobblestone streets of old Montreal and you feel like you are overseas. So if we can bring that into play, but also we truly believe that success will be a coast-to-coast pride on this in 2024 and being able to bring a little bit of each province together and really showcase our country. Because I think we're being graciously hosted in Montreal at an iconic venue in our country that will be at the time, you know, 151 years old. But to be able to bring a little bit from the prairies, a little bit from the West Coast, I mean, a little bit from the Maritimes, the hospitality you get out there, that to me would be success. If our players, if fans walked away and said they truly felt they got a taste of Canada, I think that would really be a big win for us.
Here's the thing about Montreal, too. It's going to be a great equalizer, because if that American team gets comfortable and thinks we can loosen up a night on the town in Montreal, Montreal will teach you a few lessons that you don't expect, I think is safe to say. And you guys are both laughing because you know exactly what I mean.
I think if anybody has spent their time there, there are many, many places in that fine city to enjoy some culture. And yes, that could possibly have an impact.
So, speaking of culture, I mean, obviously you mentioned, you know, different parts geographically within the country. This might be a good opportunity, especially within these times, to also explore the cultural background of the country. I mean, are you starting now to start to think about some of those different ways that you can showcase Canada? Not, like I said, not just from a geography standpoint, but from our multicultural standpoint. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it's paramount to it. I think when you think about the President's Cup being the global celebration of the game, I think it's a natural fit for us to look at all the cultures and see what we can do to bring that into whether it's this ceremonies opening and or closing, things of that nature, some of the events throughout the week. I think it would be a huge miss on our part if we didn't look at that. I also think that to be a collective and to be truly a national event for us, you know, working with all of our golf bodies in Canada. I mean, I think we underestimate how blessed we are with the golf in Canada. I mean, you know, the RBC Canadian Open, you know, that, like, I think we talked about the last time when we were on, I mean, it's almost been a resurgence of that event in the last few years. And what Lawrence and the team at Golf Canada have done, and the CP Women's Open, I believe, is out in Shaughnessy next year. So we'll be looking to get out there and spend some time with the team out there, and the Shaw Charity Classic, and then also the Mackenzie Tour, PGA Tour Canada right across. I mean, that gives us so many opportunities and touch points to talk to the golf community, but also various communities across the country throughout the calendar year. And I think that's going to be, honestly, one of the biggest tasks we have probably in the real immediate future, is to get out, get across the country, listen, ask questions, see what people think and how big they want to make this.
And it's going to be big, obviously. It's been Montreal. We're heading back to Royal Montreal almost 20 years later, which is crazy to say, when we're talking 2007 being the last time I was there. So what's your experience with Royal Montreal as a golf course, and what do you expect to see once we do get there in 2024?
My only experience, full candor, back when I was in the beer business and Sleeman purchased Unibrew, had opportunity to be out in Montreal and had lunch at Royal Montreal. And that has been my experience to date on that fine property. I have seen more aerials than you could imagine of the property since we started talking with them and since the announcement. So I feel like I've been there a lot more, but truth be told, I have not.
So to let people know, obviously you said, you know, it's an international event. People are really, you know, they're aware of what the event is as far as the players are concerned, the amount of spectators and so forth. But, you know, what's the infrastructure? What goes into it? I mean, how many volunteers? You know, what's the lead up process? What's the behind the curtain sort of things that you have to deal with that people will probably never see or appreciate?
Well, I think one of the biggest misconceptions that people, and even a few conversations I've had in the last week, is, you know, people say, well, it's only 24 players, so must be, you know, a way easier or smaller to do than the Players Championship. I would tend to argue that. The volunteer count would be very similar to what we do with the Players Championship, even for those 24 players. I think that one of the things, so I was fortunate enough to be involved in 2017 at Liberty National with the event. So really got an up close and personal look at really the weeks leading up to it. I think I spent 6 weeks on it. And to see things like what people won't see is we had a Junior President's Cup in the weekend before and leading up, which I thought was an unbelievable experience. And it's basically these kids got to experience a President's Cup as if they were on the adult team, from all the suits to the wearables to the bags to the uniforms, you name it, to finally on there when they had the official photos taken, we surprised the kids and actually brought them out onto the driving range tee when the adult team was doing their pictures. And so they got to have pictures with all of their idols and people that they've looked up to and been inspired at in their career. So there's that part of it. There's, you know, there's the international heads of state that you welcome. A lot of people don't realize that the sitting head of state of to whatever country that we are in is actually the honorary chair of the event. So whoever the prime minister is at that time would be the honorary chair of the event. So there's a lot of preparation for that. In 2017, we experienced that firsthand when we had three former presidents and a sitting president.
I will say I almost sat in George Bush's golf cart by accident at Royal Montreal. So I know exactly what you're talking about because the security detail was there pretty quickly.
Yeah, it's a different experience. And I will say, you know, I mean, there's a very good chance. And like you said, you know, President Bush was in Royal Montreal. There's a very good chance that we will have either a former president or sitting president there as well. And dealing with the Secret Service and CSIS is, I mean, that in itself, you could have a team on. And then it's thinking about the golf course and where potentially matches can end. There's a lot of mapping of the property, and you look at historical facts, you look at historical playings of it and where competitions have ended, and you try to build your infrastructure around that versus 1 through 18 in a stroke play event, you know where it's going to end.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people don't realize that about tournament golf in the first place. There's probably, I don't know, you might know the number. I'm throwing 50% of golf courses they play each year where what one person believes is the standard 1 through 18 just simply isn't the case. We were looking at a golf course recently the same way. Where it was like, well, actually, we're going to rejig this. And though it's 10 now, that'll be 18 and all sorts of things. This happens every single year. I'm sure you guys are doing that same thing with Royal Montreal right now.
We're going to take a hard look at it with competitions. The blue course there, from what I'm told and from folks in our competitions department that were there in 07, it stands up and delivers as a great match play test as is. It has been renovated since then. I believe Reese Jones did a renovation between now and then. So we'll be excited to get back up there, get their eyes on what that renovation looks like to see if there does need to be some rerouting. But as of right now, no decisions like that have been made. But when you look at Quail Hollow, for example, they have rerouted that for the President's Cup so that the sort of the green mile, as they call it, the three hole stretch that is normally, I believe it's 16, 17, 18 is a few holes back where matches traditionally do end. Usually sort of in that 14, 13 to 15 area. You want to sort of focus your hospitality in those areas.
So, you know, obviously the 2007 event, you know, Mike Weir probably had the most famous impact there. And I can tell you the media center was actually pretty much empty that year as soon as everybody found out that, you know, he was giving Tiger a run for his money.
And which is rare for a media center because they can't get away from the free food usually. But
occasionally, yeah, we'll say that for sure. But, you know, Mike Weir obviously is an integral part of this, you know, discussion. What, you know, how he's going to involve, we will see as far as from the captaincy side of it or anything like that. But outside of that, is he somebody who you will look to or have looked to already for input on what happened in 2007 and what to expect in 2024?
100%. I look forward to, we've spoken briefly with his team, and I look forward to spending some more time with him in the coming years, getting his thoughts, his take, his experience from 2007. I think, you know, spending time with all the Canadian golfers that are out on tour right now and really getting their, like I said, almost the feel and try to have them almost translate that the feel that they'd have in their heart and their soul, you know, standing on the first tee, what would they want to see? You know, when we talk about ceremonies, when we talk about different events throughout the week, you know, we're fortunate that our Canadian golfers right now are really from across the country. So to be able to get their input on that as well, I think would be great. And, you know, and honestly, you get to think about the pinnacle of the game. And if this is the pinnacle of a global event for us, we need to look across the game and talk to as many people as we can. You know, I want to see what Brooke Henderson thinks about it. I mean, she's as much an icon in our sport as any right now. And I think that would be a huge miss on our part if we didn't spend some time with Brooke and Lana Sharp and all those, you know, unbelievable players to see collectively as a game in Canada. What do we want to represent?
Yeah, I think that's almost an understatement. You know, when you think of Canadian golf, you know, Corey, Adam, Nick, they'd probably all say Brooke Henderson's the face of it, which is awesome and makes all of us proud. But what makes us more proud is seeing you involved, Ryan. We appreciate you coming on. We cannot wait to see you there, freaking out, stressed out the day before the tournament, probably finishing those final details. It's a long way coming, another 4 years, but we're excited. We're proud of you. And we can't wait to chat down the road about the President's Cup again.
Thanks, guys. Really appreciate the support. And like I say, I look forward to getting some ideas from you guys in the coming years and chatting a few more times. And when it's all said and done, we'll crack a cold one and we'll raise it and we'll celebrate.
I got great ideas. Let me know where to send them, Ryan. You'll have one each day. They'll probably all get thrown out. But yeah, you don't want to hear from me. Maybe Scott, he's more established at this point.
I'll find a P.O. box for you, Scott.
All right. Thanks, Ryan. All right. Thank you again for Ryan Hart coming on the podcast for a second time. Clearly, he's excited, proud, and we're proud of him. Nice to see Canadian running a Canadian tournament. Going to be huge. It's crazy. I didn't think about, you know, the amount of work that goes in that you need a job 4 years out. But prior to an event, talking about like getting prime ministers and, you know, who knows, you know, president of South Africa. I don't know if it's a president. I don't know what it is. Clearly, that's why he's in the job and I'm not. But I just didn't even think about something like that. It's crazy.
Yeah. The logistics are unbelievable for this event. And, you know, having been on the grounds and saw it in 2007, I mean, this event has even gotten to a much bigger level and what it's going to get to by 2024. As you said, it's a big event. It's the biggest international event for the PGA Tour as far as their property. He gave it his you know, comparison to the work he did with the Players Championship, and you think of that as being huge and the showcase for the PGA Tour. And you know, if this, as he says, is, you know, as big if not bigger, then wow, you know, that's crazy. But you know what, they got the right man for the job.
I agree 100%. But we have a major championship to chat about, and in major championship season we like to do some fun stuff. We do a draft, and this week we have the AIG Women's Open over in Scotland, and we're going to do a draft for the LPGA. Now, just a reminder, last major, the PGA Championship, we did a draft. I won. At that time, we had a bet that's the loser to play a full round of golf left-handed. So this week, if you're not following Flagstick on Instagram, start following, because Scott and I are going out next week before this podcast is released. I will be in charge of the social media for Flagstick. This might be my last podcast, depending on what I put on there. And we will be recording every single shot Scott takes for the Instagram account. It's going to be great content. Who knows? I don't know what the bet is for this, but What do you got? You got something different you want to add to it? Because maybe there might be a double or nothing. You can do two birds with one stone when you lose this draft too.
Yeah, I don't know. I haven't really thought about it too much. I mean, I came up with a bet last time. You got to be able to come up with something this time.
I'm going to leave it to the people. So what we'll do is the best suggestion that comes through Twitter or Instagram this week, let us know. We will pick the best suggestion, and that will be the bet. But yeah, we will be doing a draft for the AIG Women's Open. We flipped a coin off air. Scott won the head toss. That's not the coin toss. What am I saying?
Head toss.
We are awful today. I apologize, folks. Doesn't matter. Scott won. Scott, you got your first pick. Similar to last time, we will be drafting three players each in a snake draft order, plus one additional player. That additional player has to have 100 100-1 odds or worse. That's your fourth draft pick. Your first pick, Scott, who do you got?
Let's see. You know what? We're going to need somebody who's a strong player. Weather's going to be terrible at Royal Troon this week. We need somebody that's going to be used to the conditions and, you know, to be able to deal with, you know, maybe some adversity. So I'm going to obviously take Brooke Henderson, of course. You've got to take our Canadian job. I mean, you could have penciled that in beforehand, right?
Yeah, you could have. That's big. You know, obviously a little worried. She hasn't played in competition yet.
Sure.
But she hits bombs. She hits that driver dead straight, straighter than anyone else that, you know, I can think of. So I think it's a good pick, you know, but for me, I'm going with the hot hand. I mean, it's the best odds out there at 8-1. I got Danielle Kang. This girl is on fire. I can't not pick her. If you're going to leave her off the board on your first pick, I'm going to take her. And then with my second pick, I'm going to go a little deeper down there. I'm going with Arya Jutanagon. You know, we're coming back. Haven't really heard her names. I don't even know if she's really been playing or not, but that year she had last year, I can't not pick her.
All right. That's fair. You know what? I'll go with another hot hand as long as she's figured out her chipping. Lydia Ko is one of the strongest players in the field. Obviously she's been reborn a little bit, except for her, you know, closing holes bobble at the Marathon Classic. Definitely strong player, has some experience in this tournament in these conditions. Love the look of her swing these days. And I think, you know, I think a major's in her cards.
I like it. Okay. Now, trying to think. I got to think here. Do I want to go deep and get my, you know, I can't risk it. This is a pick from my heart. Wait, no, you get two picks in a row. What am I doing? I don't even get the pick. It's a snake draft. Okay, you're back up. Sorry.
Oh, did I? Oh,
you just took Lydia Ko. We need two.
So this is my 100-1 or worse, right?
You don't have to. That can be your fourth pick. If you want to pick it now, you can. You get three, and then you're 100-1.
Ooh, let me think. All right, I'll do my 100-1 now and take care of it. I am going to take a surprise one. Some people are probably not even going to think about this one, but I'm going to take Leona Maguire, who's 140-1 from Ireland. Obviously grew up playing in these types of conditions, used to Lynx golf courses. I think that's a quality pick for a player that's 100-1 or more.
Wow. Okay. So I get two and then you get your last pick.
Sounds good.
I don't know here. You know what? I'm going to stick with my gut. I'm going to pick from the heart. We love her caddy. She's a major champion. From Australia, Hannah Green.
Can't fault you for that one.
I turned on the TV today. I was watching some coverage. The first face I see is Hannah Green and Nate standing there out in Scotland. I was like, I got to take it. It's fate. So I'm taking Hannah Green. And then, you know, if I'm sticking with players that they're close to my heart, you know, I can't do it. I wanted to go Angel Yin. I couldn't do it. It's just, she's hitting bombs, but
I'm worried.
I'm going to go with this. She's got a breakthrough at some point. I'm taking Jennifer Kupcho. I'm taking
her. Wow.
Yeah. I think
Open Championship. Okay.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't have, it's just that, you know, She won the Augusta National Women's Open.
What are her odds right now?
She is at 126-1. So
okay.
I like right. those odds. I think it's a risk, but hey, what do you, you know, I didn't know who Maguire was, but you know, Kupcho, she's got to break through at some point here. So is it going to be at an Open Championship? I don't know, but you know, hey, she won at Augusta National, so why not?
All right, you took Hannah Green. I'm going to head down under as well for my last pick. I'm going to take one of the other top players from Australia in Minjee Lee.
Oh.
Great player, great swing, fantastic, big-time winner, big-time player. I can't lose with her. I really can't.
No, she has the second-best odds to win this thing. And probably if Danielle Kang didn't go on this run that she went on prior, Minjee would have been right up at the top. I mean, obviously. I like my team. What are your thoughts on yours? Some big names out here, some deep picks, obviously. What are your thoughts?
I think, even though I've got three players that are really high as far as the odds are concerned, I think McGuire is going to be my wild card. I think people are going to be shocked by her play. I think she's going to be inspired by being back on the Lynx soil. Royal Troon, no matter what, it's going to be an excellent venue to watch this Women's Open. Hopefully, the weather holds. It's supposed to be a little nasty this week, but hopefully at least that we don't get too much rain, so at least we can see the magnificent Ayrshire landscape of Scotland.
I think you might have an inside source, because the last time at the last Open Championship, an inside source came to you and said, look at Robert McIntyre in the top 10. And at that point, I had not heard of him. And you messaged that to me, and I said, I will look at that, and I will make money off that, which I did. So, McGuire, maybe there's something to think about. We're not telling you where to spend your money, but if the source is the same source, you could be rich. But we're talking about deep players here, right? And we came up with this game a few weeks ago, and we never got to it. We've been playing a lot of games. Scott's been bringing the games. And I came back, and I said, we're going to play a game, and it's called it's a guessing game of guess the player, kind of a where are they now type of situation. It's a player that you should potentially know. And what we're going to do is we each have two players. What we're going to do is give a bunch of different hints of who this player is. Why Scott or myself potentially should know them. Scott's going to have a great advantage at this because, he's a golf historian and doesn't forget anything. And I'm going to have no advantage and go 0-2, 100%. But basically the rules are why we should know them. We're going to have to give it a tournament they did well in or something along those lines. Their best year on the PGA Tour, how much they made. Some sort of hint potentially. Maybe it was a brand, an injury, something along those lines. And then maybe what are they doing now? Are they still playing golf or are they doing something else? So, Scott, you want to kick it off? Do you want to guess first? Do you want to go first?
Let me guess first. I'll go for a guess. Hopefully I do well in this. And hopefully the fact that I know a lot of useless bits of information, it might pay off this time.
It should pay off. All right. So this player one. So this player, their best year on tour was in 2003. They made $1.8 million. They had one win ever on the PGA Tour. That was in 2003. But they also had one win on the European Tour. So the event they won on the PGA Tour in 2003 was their first time ever playing in this event.
I'm not Googling anything. My hands are up.
In this event, it's played every single year. And when you has been played every single year since, and when you win the event, you get an exemption for a long time in that event. So he's been playing in the event every single year since. He's only made the cut four times since then. He's finished runner up one other time in that event. Same event as he won in 2003. Currently out on the Champions Tour. His best finish is T17. He's one of three players to have made an albatross at a US Open. And he has stated he's never felt like he ever belonged after winning that event in 2003 and being put up into this, aura of people that have won this event. So those are your clues.
All right.
I think the biggest hint came early, and I can't repeat it. It'll be too obvious, but who's your guess?
You know what? If this is the player I think he is, here's another fun fact. This player actually tried to get an exemption into a Canadian Tour event that we both caddied in, believe it or not, and was denied an exemption in favor of some local kids, believe it or not. And I still laugh considering they could have had a major champion, Sean McKeel, in the field.
Damn, that's good. I try to throw you off by not saying they're a major winner, but I gave you the thing of him winning a PGA Tour event and a European Tour event. The trick there is they were the same event. That's good. Damn.
That almost threw me off when you had the European Tour thing, but I thought, maybe it counts for both. Right?
That's good. Sean McKeel.
All right. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Are you sure?
No, I'm not going to get it right, but hit me.
All right. This guy was a two-time winner on the PGA Tour. He won the Canadian Tour, or won the Canadian Open in 1996.
Okay.
He currently owns a golf course in Rochester, New York, or near Rochester, New York. At one point, he owned one in the Syracuse, New York area, so not far from where we are. He and his wife have triplets, two girls and a boy. Not that that's going to help you guess too much. He did play a little bit in Canada and Argentina in 2013. He had spinal fusion surgery before it was popular, apparently, back in 2011. Managed to play in 31 majors. So this guy was around for a little bit. Became eligible for the Champions Tour in 2018, but now he splits time between playing a little bit and managing the course that he owns with his father, and he also, his partner in it is Jeff Sluman, another Champions Tour player. Wow.
I got nothing. 1996 Canadian Open. Plays on the Champions Tour.
Do you want another hint?
Give me one more hint. And
I'll give you a really good hint. Think about the guest we had this week. They both have heart.
I got nothing. I'm drawing a complete blank here. It's clearly something heart, but I got nothing. Hit me.
Dudley Hart is the name of the player. Probably not even a guy you're really that familiar with, but yeah, he did win twice on the PGA Tour, including that 96 Canadian Open.
Damn. Okay. That's good. That's real good. I hope to stump you on this next one here because that stumped me good. All right. I feel like I'm going to give you too many clues here that you're going to get this because you're just a history nut. All right. So player two, they have won two times on the European Tour. Right. The best PGA Tour year ever was in 2013. They picked up $1.6 million. That's the only full year they ever played on the PGA Tour. They're best known for finishing second at the 2012 PGA Championship.
Ooh, I don't even remember where that was.
Neither do I. Retired in 2014 due to elbow tendonitis, though they have not said they haven't ruled out playing on the Champions Tour in a few years. They're now a property tycoon. They own about 50 properties in the UK, and they once saved Ian Poulter's life as he swallowed on his tongue after going to shock in a hotel room.
What's the story on that one?
Okay.
Where do you find that?
All right. So this is a quote from Ian Poulter talking about convincing this player at one point to play on the PGA Tour, but thanking him for saving his life. Here's the story. We were in the Czech Republic. There was four of us in a room to have a shower after the tournament to try to save money. We keep one room open and all these golf clubs are thrown across the floor. I caught my ankle and the loop went down and cracked it. It was so painful. I sat on the toilet and as they ran a freezing cold bath, I put my foot in the bath and I passed out. As I passed out, my teeth clenched and I swallowed my tongue. He had to wrench my mouth open. It was horrible. So he saved Poulter's life from actually fully swallowing his tongue and choking to death. Who am I?
All right. Couple of clues there. If he's hanging out with Ian Poulter early on, chances are he's English. You said owns 50 properties in the UK, so I'm assuming that part of the United Kingdom would be England. Ooh. Now, the property thing, I think, is a little bit of giveaway, because I think I can remember reading some stories about this player. And one of the things that I remember about this player is that he was one of the players that I used to see all the time playing with the Yes putter, with the concentric grooves on the face. And he was somebody that I knew from that aspect of it. Is it David Lynn?
I don't think I could find a player you're not going to guess. That is that is amazing. It is David Lynn. The reason he popped up to me was that second place at the 2012 PGA Championship, which I believe Rory McIlroy won.
I think if you left the property stuff out of it, I probably wouldn't have had a clue. But well, I had like I said,
you know, it's part of the rules. You have to say what they're doing now, and that's what they're doing. And you know, David Lynn, not playing golf, has not played a round of competitive golf on the European Tour or the PGA Tour since 2014 due to that elbow tendonitis, which I would not wish upon my worst enemy. That is a golfer. I'm back. Mine's back. It's flared up. It's driving me crazy. So, David Lynn was my second player. All right, Scott, you're 2 for 2. Let me go 0 for 2 here and wrap it up.
All right. I might be being a little tough on you because I'm reaching a little far back beyond your vintage, but this player was the 2000 PGA Tour Rookie of the Year, so obviously fairly prominent, played very, very well. That year, he won the John Deere Classic in a four-hole playoff with Kirk Triplett.
Oh, the fifth major.
Yeah, there you go. Won twice on the Korn Ferry Tour. He ended up playing 144 events on the PGA Tour, only made 53 cuts, so obviously didn't spin that that winning streak and that Rookie of the Year stuff into too much. Last played on the PGA Tour in 2011. He did play the Senior British Open last year. He qualified for it, but really he's pretty much retired from golf for the last dozen years or so. He now lives in Houston. He's a VP of sales for a construction and infrastructure company focused on pipeline and gas industry.
See, until that last clue, I thought it might have been Brandel, because that he played last year in the 2019.
Oh yeah, in the British. Open. That's right. Yeah,
and
yeah.
It's
yeah.
Like, well, that could have been Rookie of the Year in 2000. Like, it was kind of adding up, and then that last one threw me off, and I got nothing for you. So my guess was Brandel, but I know it's wrong.
Yeah, you know what? This is probably one of the most obscure players. I apologize for giving you something that this is difficult, because most people, even if they're diehard golf fans, are not even going to remember who this guy was. Michael Clark II.
The second, too. Wow.
Not the first, the second. Not junior, the second. So, yeah. So that one's a tough one. I apologize. But, you know, just because the fact that he did have a win, had a couple of KFT wins as well, and was the Rookie of the Year, I thought I would throw that one at you.
Damn, that's good. I like the game. We'll have to fill those in another couple times. Clearly, I got to go deeper, and you got to give me a couple more alley oops here, because you're like giving me wide open shot at half, and I'm just kind of hucking at the basket and not even coming close. I need a break after that. That was a lot. Why don't we grab a quick break with the mailbag, the tip of the week, and we'll wrap up.
All right, welcome back. This is the mailbag for this week. One of our favorite segments. We answer and take care of all your questions. And you always come up with some great ones every week. We look forward to them. You can send them in via social media. So let's get to them. All right, Stefan, someone asked, what's your favorite tournament format? Now, I don't know if this is PGA Tour or amateur golf, whatever the case may be, but you know, let's just go with whatever you're thinking.
Yeah, first thing that came to my mind, partners alternate shot. That is so much fun. I've done it in small events, done it in some big ones. It's just way more fun to, you know, even, you know, the ones where you both hit tee shots and you pick one, and then you go alternate. It's a different thing. You don't get to do it often. You're relying on somebody else, which you don't really get to do in golf. You know, you blast one into an awful spot, and now your partner's over there hitting it, and he just hates your guts, and anything can happen. So for me, if I'm picking some sort of tournament style, that's where I'm going 100%.
All right. For me, Stableford. I don't think we played enough in North America. Basically, you're getting points for whatever you're doing, for pars, birdies, bogeys, whatever the case may be. You usually have a max so that, you know, over a double bogey, it doesn't really matter as far as how many points that you're going to lose. So it really rewards aggressive play. And I think that's really fun. It gets you away from thinking about stroke. You can play a net if you want. That's a good way to go about it. And really all you're doing is you're chasing your points more than anything. So I think that's a fun format. We see it a lot in the UK, but we don't see it a lot in North America. And it's definitely one that even within your group should play sometime. All right, on to the next one here. How do you bounce back after a bad first hole, triple or higher? It says, asking for a friend. And I think this is actually one of your friends who actually sent it in, believe it or not.
Yeah, I don't appreciate this question. This friend that sent it in I believe made an 8 on the first hole. So don't know if I'm the person to be asking. I started the tournament at the Flagstick. I start with a triple bogey, bogey, par, bogey start. Not my best, that's for sure. I think it was an 8 over front 9 both days. Not my best, but it's not easy. It's not easy by yourself out there. I think at that point, the key for me, and I'm still so bad at it, is not thinking that far ahead. Maybe this is thinking ahead to maybe where our tip of the week's going this week, but not thinking that far ahead. The best players I know are able to make those triples and know they're going to make birdies to cut that triple down. Again, I've yet to get that in my own head. I'm struggling, but maybe one day I'll get there.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is you got to be patient. You got to realize that after that opening hole, you still have 17 more to play. And who knows? You might have made that triple or higher later in the round.
Exactly.
You've just got it out of the way. So all the good stuff could still be coming. So I think you just got to compartmentalize a little bit. Make sure in your mind you just think about it being over. Try to play the next best 17 holes that you can. You can't do anything about it. It's done. So you keep on working that way. All right. This is an odd one. I don't know what you're going to have for an answer here. But somebody asked, where would you rather play, Great Lakes Tour or Toronto Players Tour? I don't know if they're trying to pit these tours against each other or something, but that's an odd one for sure. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, for me, I'm going to lose money on either, so I'm not going to either one of them.
Good point.
So I'm not going to answer it, but I'm going to give a quick shout out to Russell Budd, who we ran into at TPC Osprey Valley. At that point, if anyone knows Russell, he's played some Latino America Tour, some mini tour stuff. At that point, he was heading to his first tournament for this restart of the Canada Life Series. He had not hit golf balls in a couple months, I believe he said, was not looking very excited to even go play, but hey, you got to play at some point. Currently sits T4 after round 2 today at the Canada Life Series. So this guy's got some game. Shout out to Russell. Good luck on the weekend, or I guess the post cut, because it's only Tuesday and that's how this run's going. So shout out to Russell. He runs the Toronto Players Tour. Just wanted to find a place for these guys to play when COVID happened. So I'm going to give a shout out to him. Only guy I've met. So of the two, I'm picking the Toronto Players Tour.
I don't really have an opinion on this. Colin Murray and Jim Kineski do a great job with the Great Lakes Tour. They took some time off with the COVID situation going on. They're going to rekindle the tour here soon. At the same time, Russell was running his tour. You know what? I give props and credit to anybody who's willing to jump out and do these tours and run them for the players and provide opportunities. I think in most cases, you'll see a lot of the same players playing both tours. They're just trying to fill their schedule while they're waiting for Q schools and things to happen. It gives them a competitive experience. And again, I wouldn't pit one against the other. Great Lakes Tour is obviously a lot more established, been around for quite some time. Russell's gone in and kind of filled a void a little bit, but certainly I wouldn't hesitate to play on either. So I'm not going to pit either of them against each other. What would I play? I'd play them both, or I'd play none of them. How's that?
Yeah, you're going to lose money just like me, so why don't you just stay home?
Yeah. All right. Back to one of the things that we talked about here a little bit earlier, and talking a little bit about handicap. Someone asked, how many rounds do you think you should need to have to have a legitimate handicap? Apparently, the winners of the RBC Scramble had two players with under 5 rounds.
Yeah, so the 5 rounds was the old system. Scotty Mack did a quick research, and now it's only 54 holes to get in the new system. So yep. That's kind of meant to encourage people to get into the handicap system. Now, the question is, how many rounds do we think you should need to have a legitimate handicap? And I believe it's got to be at least 10, personally. At the end of the day, I know where your thought of this question is, and it's a sandbagging question. If you made it 10, if you made it 20, if you made it 30, it doesn't matter how many you're going to make it, you're still going to find a sandbagger out there. That's what you get when you play in capped events. It's unfortunate. So if you had to make it happen and you have a rules official following everyone and putting in their own scores and yada, 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 give me 10 to make it at least legitimate. But what are your thoughts?
Yeah, back in the old days, used to be 20, I believe. And then you had to use, you know, a best number of, you know, scores out of that. That gives a longer sampling period to really give an idea of what the player's ability is. I mean, you're right. Within 54 holes or five rounds, who knows what's going to happen? It's going to kind of be all over the place. But obviously, the more rounds that are actually recorded should be more accurate. But again, it really comes down to the subjectivity of the golfer themselves, their willingness to put the scores in the computer, their willingness to follow the rules. So there's never going to be a perfect system for this. So ideally, I think you're in the same range, at least 10, heading north to the 20. I mean, I get their idea. They're trying to get people to be interested in the handicap system and to get involved, and not everybody plays even 20 rounds of golf in a year. But certainly if it's going to be an accurate system, I think at least 10, you're right. All right, last one here. I see Callaway has a new Big Bertha clubs that encourage launch and less slide. Should I consider that to help me or take lessons to play normal clubs instead?
I like the quote normal.
Normal.
What I would say is definitely start with your lessons. If you haven't done lessons, you're struggling with a slice or anything you're struggling, go do that first. Get some lessons in there. However, this club could be the right fit for you. You never know. Lessons are the start. Get working on properly improving it. You're gonna, you know, the amount of work that you're gonna put in and money you're gonna put into getting lessons is gonna be cheaper than buying this golf club, and you're gonna see way more improvements than just on one club. So that's my thoughts, and I would be completely shocked if Scott has anything different to say.
Well, you know, as a coach, obviously I'm very supportive as far as the lessons are concerned. It really depends on what effort you're going to put into it. I mean, if you're only a player that plays, you know, a couple times a year, realistically, you're not going to practice. You're not going to take lessons. So, you know, getting into clubs that are more corrective, certainly tackle it. If you've got the resources to do it, you've got the money to do it, go ahead, your decision. So there's no perfect answer for this one. It's really dependent on the individual. But ideally for me, if I looked at a beginning golfer and somebody coming up in the game, if they're going to play the game for a long time and they're going to put a lot of time and effort into it, get the help, get the instruction, get the practice time in there, learn to play as properly as possible. And then, you know what, long-term, if things are not working out and you need a little bit of correctiveness from a fitting or a certain piece of equipment, then you can blend that in.
There we go. Well, that's it for the mailbag this week, folks. Thank you for sending your questions. We appreciate those every single week. We can't end each episode without hitting the tip of the week. I feel like you wrote this one for me after my first tee and weekend. Bad golf. It wasn't even awful golf for me. You know, I'm a 6 handicap nowadays. You know, it's doubled this year. Not a big deal or anything. It's gone up by double, which is great. So, Scott, I'm going to need some help here. Talk about how I can help myself dealing with tournament pressure.
Yeah, tournament pressure is a big thing. Obviously, as we mentioned, I was in the starter for this past weekend at the tournament. I saw a lot of people either, you know, heavy breathing, panicking, all sorts of things going on. I mean, you know, it was just a disaster. A lot of them were talking themselves out of hitting a good shot before they even hit it. They're looking ahead going, you know, I better not put a new ball in play. There's a lake up there. And those are not terrible players. Those are decent players. So, you know what? The big thing with tournament pressure is that, first off, playing in as many tournaments as possible, getting used to it. You know, Taylor Pender talked about it on the show last week. It's trying to get yourself comfortable in uncomfortable situations. So that's one of the first things about dealing with tournament pressure, is playing all the time in tournaments and getting used to that experience of what it's going to feel like. And if you go from not playing tournaments and just playing regular golf, and then all of a sudden you're anticipating playing in a tournament and one tournament per year, you're going to put a lot of pressure on yourself. So I would say, first thing, try to play in as many as possible, and then that will feel better that way. The other side of that is to focus on the process, not the results. Most people really get up there, they're thinking about their score. They think about their score right away. They think, man, if I make a double on this hole, you know, I'm on my way to 100. And that's part of the problem. They really have to really focus on the shot that they're about to hit and not connect it to the next shot and the next shot and the next shot. That's hard to do. You have to practice that. It's certainly a skill just as much as hitting a tee shot or a wedge or a putt. So the biggest way to deal with it is to have good routines, trying to have the same routine over and over again, whether you're playing a casual round or a tournament round, knowing that your process, pre-shot, picking your targets, picking your club, how long that you take, how you line yourself up, trying to keep that the same, whether you're playing in, like I said, a casual round or a tournament round. So keeping that process the same, that will help you make more, make yourself more comfortable. The other thing is you have to embrace it. You have to sort of welcome, you know, those butterflies in your stomach and realize that, you know, it means that you care about what's happening and really enjoy it. And it's really a mental struggle. Like I said, really got to count just the shot that's in front of you, not the next one. Obviously, on the other side of it as well, physiologically, our bodies are a little bit different when we play tournament golf, especially when we get nervous. We go into fight or flight mode. So our body actually pushes all the blood in it towards the core of our body because we're trying to survive, even though, you know, it is not really life and death, although it feels that way. So what I'd say for a lot of people is that you got to really try and make use of things like your legs a little bit more to help control your hands and arms. Otherwise, you know, sometimes you can't even feel your hands when you step up there to hit those tee shots. So it really is a psychological battle. But again, it's something that you have to practice to make yourself comfortable. And you know what? Put yourself in the situation all the time. Like, you know, play a money match, play a game, do all those things that make the round matter. And when you do that, you're going to be much more prepared for when you go and play tournaments.
Yeah, this is something I should have heard last week. So thank you for that. I feel like Adam Sandler and The Wedding Singer right now.
Once again, things that could have been brought to my attention yesterday.
But thank you for the advice. I'll bring it to my to the next tournament. Thank you though. Great episode. Thank you, Ryan Hart, for joining us. Thanks to all the volunteers, everyone that helped out at the Flagstick Open over the weekend and making it an amazing event. And we can't wait to host everyone next year because we have a blast. And it was perfect. Thank you to Equinole Golf Club for the, you know, their hospitality, the conditions of the course, the food, everything was top notch. You know, we couldn't be more proud of how it went. Just like, as I said, thank you to Ryan. We can't be more proud of him and what he's about to do with the President's Cup. And thank you for listening more than anything, because without the listeners, we wouldn't still be here. This is why we keep doing it. We have fun every single week. We can't wait to hear your suggestions of what Scott's going to have to do after playing left-handed this week and him losing another bet this week when my team just waxes his in the Women's Open. They can't call it the British Open. They don't like that over there. The Women's Open, the AIG Women's Open. Can't wait for to wrap that up. And yeah, thank you for everyone for listening. Make sure you subscribe to the podcast. Rate us 5 stars. Other than that, I think that's it. Scotty, final words?
Nope, all good. Get out there and enjoy some golf. And for Stefan, sorry, man, you're going to have to lose this next bet. Really, you are.
I might. But after you play a round of a full round left-handed, what's your over-under? Because mine was legit 200. Ooh. And I don't even think – I think I was saying 250. I got you – do you think you can break 100 from, let's say the forward tees, like 6,000 yards?
Yeah, it's really going to depend on the course. I've been known to definitely get a little bit sideways. So I'm going to say I'm 50-50 to break 100. How's that? I went out and practiced with my daughter. I took her left-handed club and played one hole. It's been a while since I played left-handed. Made a double on that par 5, but it really came down to an atrocious bunker shot. But otherwise, I was up next to the green in 3. So there is some hope, some promise. I'm looking forward to it, no matter how bad it looks on Instagram.
I never even thought about hitting a bunker shot.
Oh, it's a nightmare.
I mean, nightmare. You saw my bunker shot on 18, the second day of the Flagstick. I had a bladed out of there and hit the best flop shot of my life. Crowd was going wild on the patio. I couldn't imagine. Like, if I was in that bunker left-handed, I would have to putt out sideways and up and around. So, like, yeah, I'm so glad it's you playing left-handed. So make sure you follow us on Instagram so you can watch Scott's full round left-handed. And we're going to break it down next week, and I can't wait. So until next week, have a good one, folks. We'll chat with you then. Like today, my boat's lost in the ocean.